is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is Morgan Reynolds, Professor of Economics Emeritus at Texas A&M University, former Chief Economist in the Department of Labor 2001 and 2002. He's also served as Director of the Criminal Justice Center and as a Senior Fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis in Dallas, Texas. He's the author or co-author of 6 books, and he's become deeply involved in 9/11 research, not in support of the government's official position, but as a critic. He's focused a lot of attention on the issues of video fakery and the role or lack of role of aircraft during these events. It's a pleasure to welcome him back on the show. Morgan, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me again, Jim.
Real pleasure. I hope you had a chance to hear Anthony Lawson yesterday, who was giving a spirited defense of his criticism of various arguments that have been advanced to establish the occurrence of video fakery.
And I did.
Some of them seemed to me a bit strained, but I was glad to have him on the show so we'd have an opportunity to hear him out. I was sent today by one of our astute listeners, Jeanon in Austin, Texas, who noticed that in relation to the Nade brothers, I was making the point about how the improbability of them being in the right place at the right time, and she kindly sent me a copy of an article by Jerry Mazza, Deconstructing the Nade's Propaganda Film, published in an online journal on the 21st of February of this year. And I'd just like to read a couple of paragraphs from this very astute piece. He says, "Calculate the odds. Two French filmmakers, the Nade brothers, are filming a documentary about a young probationary fireman, Tony Benetatos, on September 11, 2001. Before the awful events yet to come, Tony is left alone at the 100 Duane Street fire station while Jules Nade, the fireman in truck, swing left from the station, drive to the first corner, turn right onto Church Street, and drive 7 blocks north to Lispinard Street and Church to investigate the report of an exterior gas leak. Then while the fire team is investigating, Jules Nade does not film them. For some reason, he turns his camera south, carefully finds a clear view past the 440-foot-high AT&T building of the Twin Towers. Then with a nano window of 6 seconds in which to catch Flight 11 stream from behind the AT&T building at 450 miles an hour, he catches perfectly the last 2 sentences of the hit into the North Tower at 8:46:30 a.m., what's commonly known in the film business as the money shot. So calculate the odds. To lend reality to the shot, Jules pans 90 degrees to the east. The pan ends with the exact centering of the North Tower in the frame, though the South Tower is right behind it a degree more to the east. But the North Tower is centered pristinely before Flight 11 zooms from the north to southwest to slam the focus tower at the 94th floor. Calculate the odds of putting your camera lens exactly where Flight 11 would make a perfect bullseye. That is, unless the event and direction of the stolen flight was known to you for enough time to practice at the perfect location to shoot almost from straight behind it. Then it turns out his brother, Gaydon Nade, just happens to be standing at the bottom of the South Tower 18 minutes later with his perfectly still camera looking up at exactly where Flight 175 zooms through the frame into the South Tower at 9:02:59 a.m., leaving a gash from the 94th floor to the 78th. He said he accidentally captured the South Tower hit while filming the crowds watching the North Tower. Consider doubling the odds. I'm telling you, Morgan, yeah, this is really something. I mean, and Anthony, I mean, I was just looking at the variety of locations in New York City, and when you get in, you know, the hundreds of fire stations and everything else, this whole thing looks quite contrived, and as though they had been, you know, setting up a pretext for the Nade brothers being in those positions at those times, but it looks incredibly improbable.
Right, and yeah, I agree. And you know, when they respond to the gas leak, for example. Now, of course, I've got to admit I'm biased because I don't buy any of these things on face value or take them at their word. But the way Chief Joseph Pfeiffer and his colleagues wander around, it looks like a complete put up. In other words, this is not an actual call for a real gas leak to detect.
They're
waiting around for a few seconds for the event. In other words, right from the get-go, you just... there was a piece here a couple years ago that I believe it was Leslie Raphael basically said there were 69 or 70 coincidences that had to fall into line for just this one event. And you mentioned the other kind of money shot of the South Tower hit as well.
That was a stunning piece of photography. I mean, I take it that's the shot looking straight up at the building from between the two buildings, Mark. And I mean, that's just amazing that that would be captured.
And, you know, from a legal point of view, I like to look at the prosecution type standards, not just science or the politics of it. The Naudé brothers have been disappeared for years now. They were around for a year or two in New York City, and you have to have the photographer testify as to the originality, the authenticity of this, and so on.
That's right.
So he couldn't even introduce this in a court of law unless. And furthermore, you know, the Naudé brothers, they look like they're young men or of roughly the same age, but they don't look anything alike. In what sense are they brothers? There are all these questions that are unanswered.
And I gather they had their attorneys bring pressure on Dylan Avery to remove their footage from his film.
Yes, and they capitulated, which is not what I would have done. I would have wanted to have it out.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think there's legal precedent here that the event and the photographing of the event are inextricably intertwined in this case, particularly in relation to the North Tower shot, which is virtually the only footage we have of it, and that, a case could be made that it's not entitled to copyright, period.
Yeah, and then... I get frustrated with all these arguments, and this is a good example where video fakery comes into play, and that is, whatever that is in the film, it's hard to, it can't be identified as a Boeing or an airliner. What is it? It's these grainy videos just leave me, shall we say, unenthused about resolving anything.
Unpersuaded.
I know the Web Fairy believes it was a flock of UAVs, right? Unmanned aerial vehicles or
something.
You can make an argument for just about anything, but one thing is clear to me, and that is it's not clearly an airliner.
Yeah.
It's just something, pixels in this film. So that goes to the manipulation question. Are they inserts? Is it real? Is it out of focus? On and on. I don't know. It's just not decisive at all.
And we're talking about, this was Flight 11, right? That was
right, American 11.
Yeah, and then we've got all these oddities about American 11 because a plane was recently put up for sale that turns out to have the same serial number as American 11.
Right, and Flight 11, of course, isn't even officially in the database. It never officially took off that morning.
A lot of curiosities. We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Hey, my special guest today is Morgan Reynolds, former chief economist in the Department of Labor in the George W. Bush administration, who's become an expert on the videos and films related to 9/11. Morgan, you know, some of our listeners may be unaware that there's practically no data on any of these alleged crashes. For example, as Colonel George Nelson, U.S. Air Force retired, who's an expert in this area, has observed, each of those planes had hundreds and hundreds of these safety-related time-replaceable parts that are uniquely identified in relation to the plane. And from all four crash sites, not a single one of these uniquely identifiable component parts has been discovered.
Right. And there's no evidence that any comprehensive aircraft accident or crash investigation was ever performed, contrary to FAA law or regulation.
I know I was startled when I was at the American Scholars Conference organized by Alex Jones in June of 2006, and Dylan Avery asked me if I wanted to see the FAA data on these crashes, and I said, sure. So he opened his computer and went through these spreadsheets, and for all four flights and crashes, every single column was empty. There wasn't a single item of information.
Right.
Rather stunning, Morgan, all things considered. And then, of course, we know two of them were not deregistered until 2002, and the other two not until 2005. I mean, what's going on there?
Right. Yeah, what's going on? It's part of the cover-up. Yeah, why are all these anomalies in play? And so it's obvious. It's just a complete giveaway that something is terribly amiss, even for people inclined to believe the government and the mass media.
I'm so amused by the claims about Shanksville, where we have multiple reporters on the scene at the time saying that the most stunning feature of the crash scene was the almost complete lack of any debris whatsoever from the crash. It makes you wonder what makes this a crash scene, you know? I mean, Colonel Nelson, again, has observed it looked to him as though someone had taken a bulldozer out there, dug a ditch, filled it with trash, and blown it up.
Right, yeah, that's my number one fact when they say a plane crashed here. Well, where's the debris? And, you know, I've been corresponding with John Lear, the well-known pilot, son of the famous Lear jet inventor and so on, and he makes a very good point about contrary to me, where I actually focus on the fragility of aircraft relative to steel buildings and steel structures of any kind, cables and whatnot, but he points out that these aircraft have enormous spars and structure that keeps engines, 6-ton engines working.
Hanging
in
on
line,
the wing.
Yeah, and they didn't find one single aircraft part in the post debris, the post justification of these buildings. So, you got a lot of explaining to do.
It is quite stunning. You probably heard this the latest apology I have heard from in defense of the government was that the lack of damage in Shanksville is because the plane, which the terrorists allegedly put into a nosedive, just happened to fly into an abandoned mine shaft.
Yeah, right. It's a landfill. And it was also conveniently at the deepest end. Yeah.
Well
that goes back to Judy Wood's undergraduate who said, gee, it's really fortunate that that airliner went down there so nobody on the ground got hurt. You know, translation, no eyewitnesses.
And, of course, if the plane had gone into an abandoned mine shaft, which, of course, is absurd on its face, we know how to deal with miners trapped in mine shafts. We have all kinds of equipment. We could have done a massive excavation. Isn't it interesting, Morgan, how none of that was undertaken, you know?
Yeah.
After all, we'd be desperate to recover the bodies at the very least. Maybe there's that miracle child that happened to survive.
Yeah, the whole thing is preposterous. When you got these wing marks that are 20 feet long, you know, and the plane is 125-foot wingspan, on and on, not one piece of airplane debris. So they didn't even respect the American people enough to have a few pieces scattered around the way they did the World Trade Center.
It is. It's embarrassing. And, of course, very similar at the Pentagon, where the actual hit point is about 10 feet high and 16 or 17 feet wide, when a 757, I mean, it weighs 100 tons. You should have a massive pile of aluminum debris, and there's none. There's no wings, which are 125 feet wide, as you observe. The tail stands 44 feet above the ground. You don't have any luggage, any seats, any bodies. I mean, it's completely bereft of what you would expect. Instead, you have some unbroken fence, some unbroken windows, a couple of cars are on fire. I mean, it's ridiculous. There's no plane. I think that Terry Meissen's, theme of Hunt the Boeing is very well founded.
Yeah, and it's Hunt the Debris at the World Trade Center, where people say, oh, the rubble pile is 5 stories, 10 stories high. or it's all compacted down in the sub basements, and yet you've got responders who are talking about. Here's a book, 2002, called Never Forget, An Oral History of September 11, 2001. And one of the canine handlers talks about this guy is employed by FEMA. And I believe it's, yeah, listen to this. He says, there were large void spaces under the surface of the rubble. We were able to climb down into them on ladders. We also lowered the dogs with rope harnesses down into void spaces that we weren't able to climb to or that the ladders couldn't reach. We did a number of void searches on the second night, and again, we came up with no live victims.
That doesn't sound like 110-story buildings that are compressed into their foundation.
There's no evidence of mass quantities, hundreds, thousand tons or more below the surface.
I don't know if you caught it when I had Father Frank Morales, the Episcopal priest who was among the first on the scene to administer last rites and so forth, who said that not only was there this virtually complete lack of bodies, which astonished everyone involved in all of this, but that actually, in relation to the North and the South Tower, they were below ground level, that there were pits. It was like these steaming pits beneath ground level, Morgan. Really stunning stuff. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Special guest today, Morgan Reynolds, a professor emeritus of economics from Texas A&M and the author, co-author of six books, is an expert on aspects of 9/11 involving the aircraft. Morgan, I was kind of struck by my guest yesterday, Anthony Lawson, in relation to a couple of points I wanted to make about the difference between verification and falsification. For example, he claims to have a disproof of a key argument in part one of September Clues, which is now in eight parts. And I was trying to draw him out to ask him, whether he thought that showing that one argument was wrong, if he were successful, would have shown the rest of the arguments to be wrong. And when I started to illustrate by, if you make the claim that all rabbits are white, you can disprove that by producing a spotted rabbit, a brown rabbit, whatnot. But to show it's true, you gotta show all rabbits are white, not just one. I thought it was kind of odd that he didn't want to talk about that.
Well, let me say a couple of things that in praise of Anthony Lawson. One is I love his voice and accent.
Yes.
Then he makes a great narrator, I believe, but not necessarily with a script written by him. The second thing is that here we have a defender of planes of some kind. He seems to believe that a DU laced aircraft of some kind went into one or both towers. He hasn't really laid that out, but at least he is a plane advocate who is willing to engage some of these arguments.
Yes.
Now, after that, I run out of good things to say.
This is an orange.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about the whole plane controversy at the World Trade Center.
Right.
And it's off-putting the way he proceeds, in my subjective opinion, and I would guess I'm not alone. For example, if you look at September Clues Busted, his first sentence is what follows is a story of deception. Well, this is not the way... I would advocate, especially coming from an academic background, that we proceed in some kind of a sifting and winnowing process.
Sounds a bit like begging the question, does it not?
Well, and then I don't know, but it certainly impugns the motives of his intellectual opponents here.
Yeah. Well, my point is it presumes what he needs to establish,
right?
That this is wrong and that it's deliberately, and it's
maybe
deliberately
this is. Maybe you can assemble the evidence and arguments that lead your jurors to this conclusion naturally, but you don't start out with this sledgehammer in the forehead. that's not the way to do it. I would so I don't even consider it very effective from a propaganda or persuasion point of view. And then his third sentence is something about wild accusations, disinformation, visual misdirection, and lies. So you know you're not going to really. It's the kind of person you can't engage very well, and that was demonstrated, I think, by your interview yesterday. And then I just want to make a few points about September Clues Busted here. That his first big issue is whether there was this fade to black in the CNN. Now I gather he's going by the chronology of September Clues, so that's okay. But to me, this is a trivial issue to dispute about, and it's hard for non-video experts to really establish this. And he claims that there is this the innocent explanation, et cetera. Now, the second thing he takes up is more interesting to me, and that is the impact, whether it was an impact sound. And, let's put this in a bigger context. Where is the sound of a deafening kamikaze airliner coming in at 550 or so miles an hour in the South Tower? Where is the testimony to that? And I've got the, again, I just finished reading this book, Never Forget, An Oral History of September 11, 2001. And very few of the witnesses who were in a position to hear in or around the World Trade Center remark about it. And I could give you I got pages after pages. Let me give you an example. Here's a guy from the fire department in the Marine Division, and he's there in the Hudson River. He just got tied up, and he says, "I watched the second jet coming in. And I watched it going over our heads. We actually saw it crash into the building right over our heads. Shortly after the plane exploded, we watched people get thrown out of the building." He makes no remark about the sound. And people who don't claim to have seen a plane make no remark about the sound. Same thing, I can prove that up. There's just, I've got page after page where people don't remark about the sound. Now, even at the Pentagon, this is true. They have three eyewitnesses here. One here's a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army, age 42, Ted Anderson, who says, "I knew that was right, and immediately I knew this was some kind of state-sponsored terrorism." Oh, that's another point he's making. Actually, I kind of like that. He says, "I knew. Whatever happened to that? Remember, this was two renegade terrorists cannot conduct a coordinated attack that successfully." That's an important point that we've maybe forgotten. Yeah. That very day, a lot of people remarked about that. Well, the next page has his comment about the no plane sound. He said, "I didn't know at first that it was a plane. I initially assumed for about the first 2 minutes that a bomb had been left somewhere in the building. And the bomb went off." Then here's another officer in the he's a staff sergeant in the United States Army, Christopher Brahman, age 33. He says, let me get his, I can't find his statement right now about no plane. But here's another guy at the Pentagon, Chief of Defense Protective Service, John Jester. He says, "I just walked into my office when the building shuttered. My office is probably 300 feet from where the plane hit. At first I thought it was a big load of furniture in the hallway. Then I thought, no, that was just too big." Now, this plane allegedly comes in at 500 miles an hour, a Boeing 757, right? Well, sound at sea level travels 767 miles an hour, okay? So the sound precedes the plane, okay? You have a couple seconds to hear this screaming, and there's almost no comment about this. Nobody comments about this thundering sound. Now, I shouldn't say nobody. Chief Joseph Pfeiffer, who was in the Naudé movie, he's one of the few in this book who comments about hearing a loud sound.
I think the sound would be traveling behind the plane, Morgan. Actually, it would be slower than the plane.
I don't even need to debate that.
Yeah.
there was a deafening sound. If there were a plane. And then he says, and then we hear this very loud plane coming overhead. That's Pfeiffer. Now, by contrast, there's, if I hope I can find this in the book right quick here, but there's another guy who talks about how they all hit the deck here.
We'll pick it up when we come right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest is Morgan Reynolds, a former chief economist in the Department of Labor in the George W. Bush administration, who's become a leading critic of the government's position on 9/11 and an expert on the planes that are alleged to have been involved here, or at least the stories about them. Morgan, you know, Anthony didn't seem to show a lot of interest in the witnesses, except for assuming that they all gave, you know, massive testimony in support of the presumption that there were planes. And of course, as Andrew Johnson has so carefully collated through, you know, 500 witness reports from the New York Times, it turns out that there's actually much less evidence here than one would presume. And that you only have one witness report seeing a United airliner, for example, hit the South Tower, and one seeing an American airliner hitting the North.
Yeah, that standard's very high, but still, it's very true that my rule of thumb is that for every person who claims they saw a plane or a plane hit the building, I can produce 10 who are people who are in equally good positions. And, yeah, that's just the eyewitness thing. I was pointing out the paucity of people who heard a deafening roar.
Yes.
In this book, this is a very interesting by contrast, as I was relaying that very few people heard the deafening roar of a kamikaze plane attacking. Here is, by contrast, Michael Mickelson, age 48, a lieutenant, former Fire Department of New York, but at that time on 9/11, he was with the Wilton, Connecticut Fire Department, and he got into town after the events at the World Trade Center. And he says, on day one, there was an ominous quiet down there because we were desperately trying to hear any cries for help or tapping or anything else. And a particularly astounding moment occurred when everybody was working and all of a sudden we heard this horrific roar. Everybody just hit the ground and covered their heads. You didn't know what was happening. And it was two F-16s doing a flyby.
Yeah.
And after you saw them, you realize, okay, at least there are guys. Now, of course, yeah, they've just been traumatized by this fantastic and costly event. And they were listening very carefully, alertly. But here, these planes are not alleged to be traveling at any 500 miles an hour. They aren't really pushing it. They're on a cruise, you know, lollygagging about as slow as they can, probably, you know.
Yeah, F-16s, I think, can hit 1,200 miles an hour anyway.
Yeah, I would imagine, yeah, even though they're old tech for the real hotshots, but still. But it just shows you the kind of roar you're going to get from a plane. You know, you were talking 120 decibels from 1,000 or 1,500 feet away. In other words, it's louder than the front rows of a rock concert. So these reports are very few. We heard this big loud roar. I can only find two in this book, and both are employed by the one was employed by the Port Authority, and one was Chief Joe Pfeiffer of the Fire Department. You know, he was the lead actor, so to speak, in the first part of the Naudé Brothers film. So, you know, in other words, I've always claimed the eyewitness stuff is not decisive because it's a mixed bag, and
sure.
you've got to have people under oath and so on and so forth, and
yeah.
You know, their credibility. And so this business about just saying, waving your hand and saying thousands of eyewitnesses or ear witnesses, that ain't going to cut it when you actually look at what is in the record.
And there's an interesting relationship between perception when the event is taking place, memory, recollecting it later, and testimony about it. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why you can have slippage at each stage, including, in the case of testimony, of course, all kinds of inducements or coercions. And in the case of memory, you can have a false recollection. If you've now seen this thing on television repeatedly, you may presume that's what you saw when it was vague and indistinct and you really weren't sure at the time.
Right. The best interviews are within a few hours of the event, because after that they do get awfully contaminated, don't they?
Besides, the most important evidence are about events that are being portrayed that couldn't possibly happen, which, of course, is part of why I'm so fascinated by the impossible speed testimony we get from Joe Keith, who seems to me to be an excellent source. I mean, here he got a retired software aerospace engineer who designed the shaker system for Boeing, which tests, you know, the vibrations, how much vibration a plane can take before it starts to fall apart, who tells us that at that altitude, which is between, say, 700 and 1,000 feet, that the planes couldn't have been going faster than 220 without starting to shake apart, and if they were going 330, that would absolutely max it out, and I presume would lead to the plane's destruction.
Well, I mean, Joe is one expert, and that's his opinion. But I would say that it's still hanging out there in terms of what a some kind of absolute limit is, either because of engine thrust limitations or airframe fragility issues. You know, resonant frequencies destroying, having the plane shake itself apart.
Isn't it fascinating how Boeing has become so coy about this information, which should be available, for God's sake, to every pilot and every aeronautical engineer and the flying public?
Well, they do have this VMO, this velocity maximum operating.
Yeah.
And
for VNE, velocity not exceeded.
Right.
So go ahead.
Yeah. Now. Yeah. And. I don't even know that for sure, but John Lear suggests it is around 360 knots on a 767, but he's going to check with some pilot friends of his who are currently flying.
Well, the beauty of this, of course, is we have five different sources, including the Royal Air Force and the FAA, that are certifying that the plane shown in the films as it approaches the South Tower is averaging 560 miles an hour.
Right. Well, that's why NIST and others just take that at face value, even though we see physical impossibilities elsewhere in these videos, right?
Well, I just love it if this should turn out to be one, because it's so conclusive.
What's that?
If it should turn out that this is a physical impossibility, that plane flying that fast at that altitude, I love it.
That's why the issue is in play now, isn't it? And I think no matter how that is resolved, and I think it will be over the next weeks, one way or the other, it is possible or it's impossible. John Lear makes a very powerful point. Let's remember, he says, he's had 19,000 hours of flying 1, 2, 3, and 4 engine jets all over the world. And he says there's no way that airplanes crashed into the World Trade Center. He's got 19,000 hours of flying jet engines, okay, and 40 years.
Yeah.
It didn't happen. One of the major reasons is because of the speed and the control factor, okay? Let's suppose you are flying at, you got this license to fly a Cessna, and this is your first time in a big plane, okay? It's laughable right at the beginning.
That's a big plane.
Yeah,
I got it. Your license to fly Cessna and you're flying a big plane.
Now you're at the
hijackers. Reported to have.
Now you got the yoke of the 767.
Right.
You are flying, at 500 miles an hour or so. You have 733 feet per second. These are John's calculations. So at 60 seconds from impact, you are 8.3 miles away from the target. Your target is 208 feet wide, okay?
Yep.
You're 60 seconds from impact, you're 8.3 miles away. Well, let's suppose you figure you need to make a little degree adjustment to hit the target.
Yeah.
You're 8 miles away and you think, that 200-foot wide thing, I can't, so I'll make a little adjustment. I'm a few degrees off. So you, well, we'll pick this
we'll
up.
We'll be right back
show.
With my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today, Morgan Reynolds, is a former chief economist in the Department of Labor of the George W. Bush administration, a professor emeritus of economics at Texas A&M University, author, co-author of 6 books, and an expert on different aspects of 9/11, including in particular the issues in related to the use of aircraft on 9/11. And Morgan, I must say I've had several corrections confirming your opinion that the sound would be heard before the plane became visible. I think I was mistakenly comparing the speed of sound with the speed of light, or of course,
you know,
with lightning and thunder, how you always see the lightning well before the thunder. But here we're talking about objects that are moving quite slow in comparison to the speed of light.
Well, there you go. You're an honest man because you made the correction, right? But hey, to go back to John Lear's little sermonette here, he could not pull this off.
Go back over this. I think this is very interesting, Morgan.
He says, I really know how to fly. Even I couldn't have pulled this off in one pass. So remember, you are going 733 feet per second. You're 8.3 miles away. You got 60 seconds to hit this 200 foot wide obstacle. Okay.
Yeah.
Now let's suppose you're 30 seconds away. You're 4 miles away now, and I mean you are going like all get out, right? Every second you're going over 700 feet. Now you decide, I need a little correction here to get this. Remember this alleged plane on the South Tower? It made this nice left-hand turn. Well, he says, and neither one of us are pilots, but he sure as heck is. So you're about suppose you want to correct 10 degrees. You're about 800 foot altitude, and you want to keep that altitude. So you roll to the right or left, let's say, with the South Tower for a few seconds,
mm-hmm.
and then you want to roll back level. As soon as you roll level, since you aren't requiring any lift out of the wing for the turn, the plane will start climbing unless you have a big time forward pressure on the yoke. Now, do these idiots that allegedly did this? No,
yeah.
And he says it's just wrestling a large airplane close to the ground at high speed is one hell of a problem.
Yes.
And you can't get experienced pilots on simulators to be able to do this, much less the idiots that allegedly did the hijackings. And, of course, let me point out that no Boeing 767 or 757 had ever been hijacked prior to 9/11 in the United States.
Yeah.
The only one that had ever been hijacked, and that was an Ethiopian Airlines thing over in Africa. So the whole thing is just this—it's just ridiculous. As I pointed out to you before, I've been on a motorcycle at 140. The NASCAR drivers are doing 220 or Indy cars. Okay. Things are happening at such a rapid clip. They've got to make one decision, you know, after the other that is good.
Yes.
And this is just an impossible task. So between so even if these aircraft could fly this fast, level at near sea level.
Yeah.
You have a real big control problem.
You want to hear?
It's just an impossible. You hit these buildings square.
You want to hear something bizarre? Months ago, when you know he was discussing 9/11 and actually attacking me, though I wasn't really fully aware of it at the time, Ed Schultz, who is apparently a pilot himself, said it would be very easy if somebody knew how to fly a small plane to learn how to do a big plane like a 757. He said all you'd need is like a half an hour in a simulator. And I thought to myself, how absurd can you get? You couldn't even figure out what all the switches and buttons and levers were in half an hour. This is ridiculous. And that's Ed Schultz.
Hey, go to airliners.net and look at the cockpit of a 767.
I know.
It's just ludicrous.
It's totally intimidating. And the idea that these guys would be capable of doing this when they would have trouble flying a little Cessna is absurd.
Yeah, you ever get in a boat? I mean, you need a little feel for that thing, you know?
Yeah,
about
absolutely.
How it reacts to inputs, even when you know what the input controls are.
Let me ask you this now. The one big argument that Anthony wanted to make had to do with whether or not the extruding nose, you know, coming through the building was or was not identical with the incoming nose of the plane and the footage, because he claimed if they aren't identical, then of course it can't be the use of the footage of the plane in both places. Did that
I was like you. I thought, hey, I don't have any big insights here whether they're identical or not, and I don't really care about grainy frames from videos, to be perfectly frank. The whole thing so many grounds is impossible. Here's a claim that I wanted to pick on, where he said remember he's talking about the September clues supposedly distorted the testimony of Teresa and Chelsea. And at one point then Anthony says 2.8 miles is nothing on a clear day. 2.8 miles? I'm looking out my window here, and I have a ridge across the valley. It's about 2 miles, I would estimate. I can't, with the naked eye, or go along an interstate in a flat a piece of land.
Yeah,
and the exit you're looking for is 2 miles up.
Yeah.
Now you might be able to see the overpass, right?
Yeah.
But you're not going to be able to 3 miles away. You're not going to be able to pick out much of anything
in terms of detail.
But he says it's nothing on a clear day. Well, maybe I'm too old, but my eyes are correctable to 20/20. So it's just a business. I'm saying what?
Yeah. Well, my concern about his nose cone comparison was the video he was using, which was apparently different than what was being used in September Clues, and whether you could replicate it and, you know, have some kind of authenticity confirmation for its origin. I mean, it's too easy to manipulate video images in this digital age, so I was very reluctant to express any concurrence absent some form of verification that what we're looking at is bona fide, where I think Ace is probably the best position among us to discuss it.
Right, yeah, and that makes me a little worried, because you have to really get into video detail and expertise to resolve these. And
That's exactly right, Morgan, which is why I was so hesitant. You know, I mean, I've been all through this with the Zapruder film, and I mean, it's so intricate and complicated that for him to think that I should be able to say yes or no just by looking at his images presented his way is just asking too much. I'm not in the position to do that.
Well, because I was not very interested in that issue, let me ask you a question. Is it the claim... See, this goes back to reminds me of the Chopper 5 issue, where Ace argues that they screwed up, and then there's this nose that emerges on the northeast side of the
This is what we're talking about.
Oh, okay. And then there's
Ace has a different argument about Chopper 5, namely when you stabilize for the helicopter, it should induce stabilization in the image of the plane, and it doesn't.
Well, my point would be, of course, no nose cone could emerge.
Could have anyway, of course.
Yeah. So anybody who shows a nose cone of any kind, I don't care if it matches your nose cone or not, it's just absurd on its face. It's physical. Sir Isaac Newton refuted that over three centuries ago.
Well, I'm inclined to agree it's a blunder, too, that they just, you know, this was a terrible mistake. He also made a big deal that when you have a fade to black, you fade in and out instead of have a black screen that says fade to black. But obviously, it just depends on what system you're using. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. Today, my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, and I are discussing his research in relation to the planes and videos of the planes on 9/11. Morgan, as you know, I was able to squeeze in with Anthony my top five arguments, which are none of which is derived from September Clues, which include the impossible speed argument, which I like a lot, the wake vortex phenomena that Ace Baker has discerned, the cutout silhouettes, the absence of them from the plane entering the building, which also is Ace's work, the repetition of frames in some of the footage where Ace has discovered the background frames are repeated frame to frame, and yet the plane is progressing. So you got two frames with identical background, yet the plane is moving across. And, of course, his Chopper 5 composite work. I really like those. I know they aren't identical with your list of your top five. Were you impressed with any of Anthony's remarks in relation to any of those? I was kind of struck by the one about the cutout silhouettes being absent, where he suggested that was because as the plane was entering the building, the wall board was powdering and concealing, filling up the blackness of the silhouette. I thought that was a bit much, but it was an answer. At least he had an answer.
Well, yeah. I call that, hope that we're on the same page now, that I call that the healing up. Yeah, where you see no silhouette of passage, no cutout outline momentarily, and then there are explosions after the plane is completely swallowed. Well, they're just, that's absurd, of course. In other words, the videos that show a penetration of the South Tower don't show a crash. They don't depict a collision. So that it's just ridiculous. And in a real aircraft collision, of course, that the ignition of this fuel and the associated explosions is immediate. You'll recall my Madison airplane PowerPoint sequence.
Yeah,
they just light up right away. So there's so many things wrong with that. And actually, I wanted to go back to a comment you made regarding how easy it was to fake a video and photography these days.
Yeah.
And one of the things Anthony Lawson critiques is about, well, we got all these videos, and he mocks the idea that there's therefore a conspiracy of involving so many, right? And we got all these witnesses that none of whom are apparently named by him specifically. But let's recall, there are about 40 of these videos out there. If you look at Kill Town, right, you know, about 40 of these different videos. A handful of them show the South Tower penetration issue. But remember that these showed up days, weeks, and even years later. Okay, and why are there so many and there are none at the Pentagon? There were a lot of people around the Pentagon. There's a lot of people out at the mall, all, you know, taking tourist photos and video. And if this Boeing Flight 77 is doing all these crazy stunts, where are the amateur videos there? You know, all we have are these five frames from this parking lot.
Like that, Morgan. That's a really nice point.
It's just a stunning contrast.
It is.
The idea that you can't, in fact, it makes it more suspicious that there are so many for the World Trade Center, so many. And here's another factor. Why aren't any of these attributed to network employees? Why are none of the cameramen, they're all amateurs, supposedly, or freelancers or whatever. Isn't that a way for the media to keep this complicity at arm's length? You know, throw some of these guys to the wolves, and hey, we're just innocent users of these videos. We took them at face value, just like NIST is going to argue when all hell breaks loose.
Well, you know how in part four of September Clues, called the Dense Coincidence Dance, we discovered that at least 17 of 18 featured witnesses to various plane crashes were employees of networks.
Right.
Stunning, Morgan.
Well, 17
witnesses they put on the air are employees of the networks.
Yeah. And, well, you know who set the table there? I hold CNN up as number one, as the lead dog in this whole show, because the first broadcast report of the plane hitting the North Tower was Sean Murtaugh, a vice president at CNN, who calls into the anchors there from his Penn Plaza window. He's about 3 miles. I can't remember the. I did work on this a year or so ago, where he's claims that a Boeing 737 or similar just flew by him. He's about 3 miles north of the World Trade Center complex at 5 Penn Plaza, and he calls us in and hey, come on, this is He is not a credible witness for a lot of reasons, one of which he's way off on the order. He says seconds later he hit the, well, if you do the calculations, it would have taken 20 seconds for it to fly down there.
Yeah.
Far. There are a whole bunch of things that I put up in one of these articles wrong with why he, you know, he's a credible witness to a lot of people, right?
Yeah,
he's a vice president at CNN, and he's in New York, and da da da. So that set the table right quick.
Yes, yes, indeed. Well, you know, something I'm fascinated by, Morgan, is that your set of your top five list doesn't correspond with mine, and of course, a lot of your concerns have to do with the exact physical features of the impact of the plane with the building.
Yeah.
I think something we want to do for sure while we have this opportunity is to go through your list.
Well, did I give you it? Actually, I gave you that in an email, but just off the top of my head.
Well,
number one.
I'll remind you, and then you can expand on it.
Okay.
First, the lack of large quantities of plane debris below the impact gashes and in the gashes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you want to do the whole list or have me? Let's have me comment. I don't have to write it down again. There are very few reports of any serious amount of plane debris, and all of these impacts that we know of between planes and buildings leave a lot of plane debris below the impact zone as well as in the gash where the collision occurred.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today, Morgan Reynolds, former chief economist in the Department of Labor of the George W. Bush administration, is an expert on the issues of video fakery in planes, no planes, at the World Trade Center in particular. And, Morgan, we were just starting to compare my top five with your top five, and the very first I was mentioning of your top five was the lack of large quantities of plane debris below the impact gashes and in the gashes.
Yeah, and that's pretty obvious. But a 767 has 3.1 million parts, according to Boeing.
3.1 million parts.
Yeah. Well, you know, plus the contents that weren't burned up. And John Lear actually makes a point that I made earlier regarding, first of all, these planes would have had 2 6-ton engines each. Well, where are they?
Yeah.
You know, this pathetic turbo piece out of a 737, it's a much too small an engine to power 767s, which use these huge either GE or Pratt and Whitney.
Yeah.
And John Lear makes a really good point. He claims, hey, United Airlines, which was a plane that allegedly hit the South Tower.
Yeah.
Only exclusively use Pratt and Whitney engines. So anything GE, you know, north of the South Tower, it's absurd. It's a planted or salted evidence. You know, it didn't come from it's just ridiculous. And he points out further, you know, given these huge forgings that keep the main pieces of a huge plane like this together, they would have survived something called a collapse. There's no huge spars and forgings, you know, like the main spar out of any one of these wings. You know, and the wingspan is 156 feet on a Boeing 767.
Yeah.
But go ahead. Okay, what did
I say? No. I mean, and the engines were not recovered from the Pentagon, and of course, nothing was recovered from
Jane. You know, that's stainless steel, titanium, and other stuff that you ain't going to disappear that with a kerosene fire.
Stunning. Yeah, your second top five with South Tower penetration videos show no crumpling or loss of airplane pieces, but simple disappearance into the building. There was no crash.
Right.
That's impossible. This is very closely related.
Sure. Yeah. So let's go to three.
Third is your cartoon-like cutouts or gashes in both towers as an impossible silhouette for the passage of the planes.
You know, people expressed outrage, and this is due to Dr. Judy Wood and my, we'll call it plagiarism, but when you have Tom and Jerry type cutouts, you know, when when the mice or the cat run through the wall,
right.
or Wile E. Coyote,
Roadrunner.
Yeah, that's not the way crashes are. They don't make an exact cutout or something nearly identical to the outline of this aircraft.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous.
Well,
so,
Judy told me how when she showed a colleague of hers in the Department of Mechanical Engineering at Clemson, you know, these cutouts, and explained that that's, just showed him. He said, something's wrong. I mean, all he had to see was the cutouts, and he knew something was wrong. And I'd say that's got to be true of a whole lot of professionals all over the country. They know something is terribly wrong.
Yeah. It's careerism and fear and whatnot.
Yeah, it would be nice if like you and Judy, they would simply speak up.
And then, you know, this cartoon-like cutout, it immediately comes to mind that the plane is hitting the building at an angle. So in the case of the South Tower, it's turning left, and the right wing will hit it first. The left.
Yeah.
And then it'll the plane will be spun counter clockwise toward the east, and it's gonna break off a tail section and so on. In other words, these crashes, while they have some predictability, I call it mostly chaos. And
yeah. Some of the crash videos you showed in Madison, and by the way, the DVDs for the conference should be available, if not this week, then next, were really quite convincing, Morgan, because you showed even on a simple hard landing you could have the tail break off of a plane.
Yeah, one of them was a large plane, too. It was a DC-8 or similar. Right.
Rather stunning. Then you say, number four, cartoon-like gashes are undersized and obstructed, therefore a too large plane could not disappear into the towers.
Right. The hole does not fit. You must not
You must quit. Yeah,
so it's just, that's just simple stuff. It's interesting that NIST, you know, they do these diagrams based on photos of the size of the all the obstructions. Well, you know what their argument is? Shredding, and then all the shredded parts go into the building, or nearly so. It's just not going to work. And if there were these, you didn't have a clean hole. It's undersized and it's obstructed. There's going to be hung up parts. And where are they? They're not there.
And number five on your list, an aluminum plane cannot glide into a steel concrete building and disappear because the weaker structure would suffer the largest share of the damage. The plane would be rejected by the building. Newton's third law applies.
Yes. Now, Anthony Lawson surprisingly took that on, full frontal assault, and claimed that an airplane has a structure that is stronger than a steel and concrete tower.
Yeah, he said the tensile strength of aluminum was greater than that of steel.
Yeah, actually, the aluminum, I had that in the plane PowerPoint, too. It is slightly stronger than steel on one of those dimensions, one of the four.
Yeah.
But is distinctly inferior on the other three.
I know. Tensile, is that the ability to be strung out into thin pieces?
I think that's deformation. But
okay.
You ask Judy, Dr. Wood, on that.
But, yeah.
It's steel is certainly stronger on ultimate strength or failure, et cetera. And then to have this proposed seriously, when you've got these concrete steel floors, for example, concrete and steel, with that leading edge, the whole plane is going to encounter about five or six of these floors,
yeah,
much less the wall. I go back to my sledgehammer and a piece of aluminum tubing. You know, which one's going to fare better? It's just not a close call, and yet he's defending the plane structures being stronger. Do they ask you to weigh? Do they weigh your luggage? Is one way to put it when you go into a building. I mean, a building, because buildings don't have to worry about flying.
Yeah.
The redundancy in a building is enormous. You know, it's 6, 10, 20. And down there, you know, there are economics involved here. because the buildings in downtown Manhattan, it's a lot different than putting up a silo in the middle of Kansas. Because, you know, you got to have a lot of redundancy because you don't want anything going wrong, like the building toppling, let's say, in a hurricane. So the plane being stronger than the building, yeah, and this impact at the end of the Lawson video, which is titled Impossible Speed Busted,
yeah.
He says, The speed was possible and the impact was possible. No. The latter, the impact was possible. No. Uh-uh. Newtonian violations here.
Hey, you classicists, you will be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, who believes in classical physics. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today I'm concluding a conversation with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, a professor emeritus of economics at Texas A&M, author, co-author of 6 books, and an expert on different aspects of 9/11, in particular on issues related to the aircraft that were allegedly involved. Morgan, as you well know, I personally had a tremendously difficult problem confronting these issues until I realized there was a difference, a separation of issues between video fakery on the one hand and planes or no planes on the other. If the videos are authentic, of course, then there had to have been planes since they're portrayed therein. But if there's fakery, there might still have been planes because it could be that the fakery was intended to conceal features of those planes or of their interaction with the buildings. Or, of course, there could have been no planes. The fact that there's a 17-second gap between the time of these events and the time their broadcast occurred, as is portrayed in September Clues, seems to me to be of vital importance, and that no one should commit the blunder that Anthony Lawson displayed of supposing that all of this was contrived in real time right there on the scene rather than prepared in advance. And, of course, as you have sought to emphasize, I mean, you had to have control over these events, because if you don't have the plane crashes, then you don't have hijackers. If you don't have hijackers, you don't have Islamic fundamentalists. If you don't have Islamic fundamentalists, you don't have a tie into Afghanistan, Iraq, and a war on terrorism. So I think that your analysis here of why it was almost indispensable that they have complete control over what happened here is probably right on the money.
Well, there were, I can prove, there were no plane crashes. It's physically impossible, given the evidence we have. Now, there was, you agree, there was video fakery. Now, of course, one of the big questions is, why do they need video fakery if there were really plane crashes?
You know? Yeah.
Now, there could have been, I had a speculative article, and this has kind of been renewed in my own mind in my discussions with John Lear. I had a speculative article that I've mentioned before where you could have had a flyby. Even I doubt this, but it was interesting speculation because they have the technology to do this. You could have had a flyby by a large plane that could suddenly turn invisible with stealth technology. In other words, it's that might be why they chose a day like September 11, 2001, when you had a crystal blue sky. In other words, it's like turning the underside and even the top side of a plane into computer screens that are sky blue.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't know that they really needed that, and now there's kind of renewed speculation that Lockheed Skunk Works actually has some kind of technology that would take us back to the whole disreputable hologram technology.
Fascinating.
But, so, you know, it's kind of, is it Frankenstein, you know, a monster walking back into the picture? The reason I rejected holograms was not that it wasn't kind of an interesting idea, but I doubted that there's no evidence that they have this technology. But, you know, hey, secret technology's there that we don't know about.
Absolutely.
So it can't be, you know, 100% dismissed. So this idea, as I understand it, you know, one more aspect of this is it's much harder to excise an image, especially a real image, you know, from a video than it is to insert one. So There's more problems excising a real plane, even if it didn't crash, than there is inserting a plane image.
Let me mention, by the way, that scientific reasoning is inconclusive. I mean, what we're doing is comparing likelihoods, which are determined by the probability of the effects we observe of the evidence we have available if we assume the hypotheses to be true. So you compare all the hypotheses, assume they're true, and determine what probability they would confer on the evidence. That yields their likelihoods, and then the hypotheses with the highest likelihoods are preferable to those with lower likelihoods. So none of this has to involve the decisive or complete elimination of alternatives. You compare their likelihoods and find out which are the preferable hypotheses, and then as the evidence settles down or converges, you have a justification for accepting the hypothesis with the highest likelihood.
Well, I'm a strong believer in certainties. We do know some things for certain and can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. But there are aspects. We're never going to know everything about the crime. And this is true in all criminal prosecutions, most of which are successful. So where there's going to be some uncertainties, but we keep on pushing here and pushing there and learning things as we go. That's what's really important, and ultimately, of course, we hope to break this wide open and have some legal hangings or similar, where real perpetrators have been convicted and real legitimate courts of law.
And let me just add, I mean, the more and more I've got into this, the more convinced I become not only of the existence of video fakery, but of the very strong evidence suggesting that there were no planes for all the reasons of maintaining control and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm very inclined to view that as what appears to have been the case, Morgan.
Right. And, that's just re-emphasized here. I think most of these arguments have been put out early, but when I'm talking with John Lear, I'm really impressed with how impossible this speed and control issue is. For him to say, I can really fly. He flew the Lockheed L-1011 the last 15 years of his career, and before that it was a Boeing 707. Well, the Lockheed TriStar L-1011 is a bigger plane than the 767s that allegedly went into the World Trade Center. And he says, there's no way. There's no way I could ever do this on a first pass.
So, well, I've had several pilots tell me that, you know, five times out of the six, they'd be unsuccessful doing it. And
okay. Well, maybe you could get one in six, but no first pass success. I hope he does this. He's talking. He knows somebody who has a 767 simulator out in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And he wants to rent it for an hour and put some different people in the seat.
Yeah.
And have them videotaped and interviewed afterward. And I'm very confident nobody can do it.
Well, given how much resistance you've encountered during the long period of time you've been researching this, what would you say to those of our listeners who still find it difficult to get their mind wrapped around the idea that there could have been no planes and all these videos could have been fake?
I think the main problem is to forget these TV images. It reminds me of the Ford Edge ads. The Ford Edge, which is this crossover SUV.
Yeah.
And they show you it running two wheels along the side of a building high up in the air, 20 floors off the street. Well, we all know that's impossible. That's all fakery, right? But our major problem is that the media have psyoped the American people. And when the American people, more of them are thinking about this through every day, now, hey, we're making some progress, I claim, on the no planes issue. That's the main obstacle, are these TV images that they've got. Oh, there were planes.
Well, Morgan, that trips into an area where I think that we are so exposed to impossibilities all the time in images and television programs and movies that it's corrupted our capacity to judge the difference between reality and illusion. We're just fed so many illusions on such a constant basis that it weakens our critical capacity to think things through.
Yes, and hey, the other side of that coin is if it's not on TV or it's not mainstream, it's not for real.
Morgan, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. We're certainly going to do it again. Keep up your good work. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. I want to thank you all for listening.